So once again tonight we will read and comment on a letter from Yuan Wu. This one is called Teaching Zen. And he begins, "Surely you have seen this saying, the one road to transcendence is not transmitted by the thousand sages. And then he goes on and says, if you have directly experienced the meaning that is not transmitted by the sages, then you have indeed finished the work of the path. First of all, essential to this matter of teaching Zen, and this letter, like them all, is represents a facet of Zen, this mysterious thing called Zen. This one happens to be called Teaching Zen because it does, to some degree, emphasize that act that we call teaching. But really, it's about this fundamental thing called Zen. Now, in the matter of teaching Zen or experiencing Zen or knowing Zen, words are very, very dangerous in a sense. They can be inspiring. They can be suggestive, they can be a jumping off point, but by no means is this matter to be found in any kind of prolonged working with things that can be put into words. The words can point us in a useful direction, but words are very dangerous too, because for the main reason that they hook into an old way of thinking. The use of words is based upon the idea of breaking up the world into parts. And we name the different parts and we come under the delusion immediately that those things that we have named actually have separate reality. And we utilize the mythology of time, very useful scaffolding upon which to place our memories and fantasies about the future and so on. But when we look into it experientially, not thinking-wise, but experientially. The more intensely we are experiencing anything, the less important time is, and ultimately you can't find time. There is just this. So words, while useful, have to be very, very careful of them. And particularly right at this very opening paragraph where he says that if you directly experience the meaning that is not transmitted by the sages, then you have indeed finished the work of the path. It implies that the path is a sequential series of events or stages through which one can go in order to achieve something. And this is, of course, a falsehood. It is already here, fully developed, manifesting at every second. And so what is this matter of finishing the path? Is there any ending to anything that has never begun? So this is very, very dangerous. It invites one at the very beginning to jump into a false conception of what this matter is. Seduces one in a sense to say, well, if one does this and that, then one can complete this great work and come to a full Buddhahood. That kind of thinking is very dangerous. If one is really concerned with the actual spiritual work. So I would urge you, even though it is written in all goodwill by this great teacher, Yuan Wu, to immediately have little lights go on, little flags come up in your mind, and realize that this is, you're entering a dangerous swamp of quicksand. So he goes on, he says, if we directly discuss this matter, there is no place for you to use your mental machinations and no place for you to approach and settle in. That is why Zen adepts, ever since ancient times, have only taught via direct pointing. They wanted people to reach mystic awakening outside conventional categories. They did not want people to slog through muddy water or fall into sensory entanglements. Now, he's making an important point. But again, it's full of pitfalls. It is difficult to use words without, at the same time, risking that the very words that one uses to attempt to point to something will be taken in a way that leads in a non-productive direction, you might say. So he rightly says that if we directly discuss this matter, there's no place for you to use your mental machinations and no place for you to approach and settle in. So you can't really find a comfortable place, and there's no way to use your mental machinations, that's a nice phrase, the skillfulnesses of the logical and articulate mind. There's no place where you can use those in order to get any kind of clarity on this matter. So it's a very awkward place to be in if one relies only on these mental machinations. But if one is quiet, which is part of the essence of the practice of Zen, one quietens this mind. And one comes more and more into direct contact with the actual sensory experience beyond all names. The sound of the wind. The sound of the little beings in the attic here, whatever they may be. The physical feelings in your body as you sit. The rise and fall of the breath. The odor of incense, whatever it may be. And somehow stretches to allow that to be a place of revelation without needing to have a place of revelation, without wanting to grasp it in order to perfect anything, but knowing that the essence of this great matter is to be found in enormous simplicity, an enormous quietness, an enormous awake presence to the actual reality that presents itself to you at every moment, then the work of Zen is being accomplished in a lively way. So he talks of direct pointing. Do not want people to slog through muddy water and fall into sensory entanglements. And yet, there's always this and yet. This very thing that one could say is slogging through muddy water. That is to say, through, let's say, the attempt to explain and understand through reading of the sutras or whatever, this matter of Zen is itself a perfect and complete manifestation of this great body of Buddha. What this says is a great kindness and a great acceptance has to be present in this work. It is not as though what is done in this place or this domain or in this manner is the true Zen work, but rather a shift of attitude to find this true Zen work where it always resides, in the individual elements of our experience of every moment. Whether it be slogging through the muddy waters, whether it be in what he refers to here as sensory entanglements. Sensory entanglements might be giving too much reality to various emotions which in themselves are mere transient sojourners through the field of consciousness. Or arising out of a desire to have pleasure and happiness and wanting to push away anything that seems to be the opposite of that. All these things characterize a life that is lived in a dualistic world. Trying to get the world to be a certain way. Trying to get more of this and less of that. Whereas the work of Zen is embracing finding in every moment, every step. It is, as a matter of, dancing with the sadnesses, dancing with the elations, dancing with fatigue, dancing with energy. That is to say, being one with, what is a good dancer after all, but being one with the partner so that momentarily that sense of duality disappears. There is only one thing. And likewise here, being at one with whatever is happening and allowing it to have its duration without having it make any statement about itself, about time, about one's life. Being unconcerned about whether it matches the world that one has hoped for or not. But it is what it is. What is it? Shh. Don't try to name it. What it is beyond all names or designations of sadness or joy or whatever. We're speaking here of intimacy. An intimacy that is not prevented by a mind filled with necessities to give words to things. In this intimacy, life grows. Life grows in every kind of intimacy. The intimacy between two friends. The intimacy of oneself with the, just for a moment before I came in, look up at this crystalline sky tonight with these points of light that we call stars. With the bare branches that are so sinuously silhouetted against this night sky. Just that, just that. Beyond all thought of these, the number of stars, how far away they are, what the names of the constellations are, or that it is now winter and all the leaves have fallen and whatever. Just this. Is it cold? Is it hot? Is it sad? Is it joyful? Oh, this is unnecessary. It's just this. Just this. That just this will teach us, will reveal this matter to us. It is directly pointing to that. That is the optimal way to teach Zen. So, he goes on, he says, thus it is said, the superior type get up and carry it out as soon as they hear it mentioned. 1,000 devices cannot take them in, and 1,000 sages cannot trap them. Now, superior type is not someone who is, you know, endowed with great knowledge or anything like that. But it's a person who gets it, who realizes the preciousness of one's life, who has incorporated into their body-mind certain guidelines for operating in the world, such as not being seduced by these thoughts that come in and want to give names to or put judgments upon things. They cannot be trapped by anything. He says they cannot be trapped by 1,000 sages. 1,000 devices cannot take them in. I would say 1,000 thoughts, 1,000 judgments cannot deter them or make them turn aside. One sees them all for just this flow of karma. There is no self attached to it. It just comes and goes and moves and transforms. And there's no self to be found in it. Nor any yesterday or tomorrow, nor any birth or death. It is just this. Entering into that without thought of gain is a way for the practice of Zen. He says to be a genuine Zen teacher, it is necessary to study like this and experience entry into the path like this. And it is necessary to propagate the path like this and to extol the path like this. How could this be a matter for dullards? Again, dullard is not a judgment upon a person, but it is someone who does not realize that awareness and presence is the key to all of this. awareness and presence to the degree that one is not fooled by these thought patterns, these emotional ups and downs. One does not deny them, one does not push them out, one may fully experience them. One is not seduced by them to make them more than they are. Transient sojourners through this field of consciousness. He says, every true teacher must have eyes like shooting stars and be able to kill a person's false self without blinking an eye. And then is there, and only then is there accord with the path. If you hesitate and get hung up, you've missed it by 1,000 miles. Now this matter of killing a person's false self, there's a lot in Zen and Zen metaphor about the sword that kills and gives life. So that kills helps a person to be rid of an addiction to a false self or false ideas about time and life and so on. Now, when I say false, I do not mean that there is a true one in contrast to it. But I mean it as making real something that has no substance. That's really what it is. False is really making real what has no substance. So the process of Zen is looking into whatever comes into your field and seems to be getting solid. You look into it and you ask, what is the solidity here? What is this really? Am I just falling heir to a thinking pattern that endows this, whatever it is that one is experiencing, this conclusion about oneself or life or whatever it may be, one's success or failure as a Zen student, whatever it might be, am I looking at this because it's just a filter that I have, because it's a habit pattern? Where in what I am actually experiencing is this Zen student that is not successful or successful? Where is this in this very experience of the moment? Where is this thing that I'm concluding about life or about myself? Where is it actually? And you ferret it out until you see that it is nothing. And you learn how to live without having to have any idea of self. Remember old Bodhidharma who came before the Emperor Wu, and when asked by the Emperor Wu who he is, he said, I don't know. Everybody thinks that this is a given, that we are in a search for the self, and the self is an entity, and we are distinct selves, and to find that is a big deal, and all that. But the honesty is, you can't find it. The reason you can't find it is it doesn't exist. It's one of those things that one makes real, but that has no existence. What is it then? This is what fuels the inquiry, the penetrating into of Zen. Until you find this very self in the smell of incense, in the footfall as you walk around a zendo, in the withered leaf that twists and turns in the wind on a tree, in the sparkling of stars at night. There you find it, in the rise and fall of the breath. But you have to be quiet and have let go of these habit patterns of putting interpretations onto whatever occurs to you at any moment. So one of the great three pillars of Zen is trust, sometimes called faith. Trust that if you do this, if you truly let go of these things, without thought of letting go in order to get anything, you find that realization will come your way. He goes on, he says, only when you are at the stage where you possess this ultimate treasure can you set up myriad distinctions. Now, that means that when you really know the ground of being, you really know this one reality as your home, as the way things are, then you can create myriad distinctions and you can enjoy the ability of the mind to concoct things and to calibrate things and to construct strategies and reach goals and all of that. But you are free of this, of these endeavors having any relationship to a self. And then you are really free. He goes on and says, if you have really reached such a stage, you will never concoct strange things or impose arbitrary forms or create rigid models or rote patterns. And there's so many folks, are there not, even within the realms of Buddhism, that create formulas and rituals and fixed ways of interpretations and, as he says, concoct strange things or impose arbitrary forms or create rigid models. This is most characteristic of fundamentalism, characteristic of the reification, the making real of the various mythologies that are central in so many organized religions. But in Zen, no, we create none of these things. No strange models, no addiction to these mythologies, nothing. And the courage of doing that creates the space where what is really so can begin to animate you and be a source of life that is beyond any dark clouds, you might say, or fears. He says, you just keep open and free. And even this cannot be grasped. That is to say, this mind, the Buddha saw this so clearly. The mind that wants to grasp things, wants to get something. That's why he said that the source of suffering is wanting or desire. But if you don't need to grasp anything, you don't even need to grasp a concept. You don't even need to describe some great insight that you've had. Can let it all be. It says, when you establish yourself and penetrate through to freedom and dissolve the sticking points and remove the bonds to help other people, it is always done according to the place and time. In other words, it is always about the present circumstance. There are no rote formulas. It is always responding to this circumstance right here, this person in front of you, this particular location in time and space. This is how Zen honors and respects each individual. And each moment as being fully and complete the place of manifestation, the place of realization. Utilizing the way the mind of any given person operates to be an entry gate, a place where that individual can find a foothold, you might say, along the path. So he quotes Rinzai and says, Rinzai said, what I see, I want all people to know. And this is an expression of compassion, because in a sense, while everybody is manifesting totally and fully this great body-mind of Buddha, this great one reality, it is not known to the vast majority of people because they instead are encumbered by this capsule of interpretations of life and the world to which they are addicted. And this addiction keeps them from knowing what is. So Rinzai says, what I see, I would want all to know. That's the motivation of any teaching situation. And yet, strangely enough, without agenda. But watching for the little openings, the little possibilities that might be a place where an opening could occur. So he goes on and says, how could this be something that crude worldly thinking can assess? Crude worldly thinking is not making a distinction between the mundane and the spiritual, but rather it is emphasizing the crudity, you might say. Crude because it is utilizing concepts and making them real as though they were real, whereas they're just arbitrary conveniences, and if they're not useful, let them go, or make new ones. The crudeness is being blinded to make things real that have no substance. And that characterizes most of the world and leads to most of the great suffering in the world. The hurts that are inflicted upon other people, the genocides, the wars, the tribal behaviors of exclusion and criticism and judgment and all kinds of things that go on. He says you must gather together all your false thoughts and calculations and attachments to sentiments and sensations and judgmental views and cut them off with one stroke. Explaining and distinguishing true nature and the true pattern will never be the fundamental. You must get free of all of this and get your own realization. So again, emphasizing, although in a chapter called Teaching Zen, it is once again reiterating that which is important for every true practitioner of the way of Zen. Realizing the not only the non-usefulness of these, what he calls false thoughts, calculations, attachments to sentiments and sensations and judgmental views, and so on, or explaining and distinguishing true nature and the true pattern, and so on. All this has to be quiet and let go with some humor and some kindness. As you know, that I always say to folks, minds do that. You have a resident mind, and what can we say? Minds just do that. It's just their habit. Let it be. Let the mind do whatever it wants over in the corner. It's all right. Going on, he says, then all the objects in all the worlds of the ten directions are contained in the space of the tip of a single hair. That is, after you let go of the idea of here and there and yesterday and tomorrow and gain and loss and all the rest of it, every moment, the tip of a single hair is such a an extreme yet clear statement of it. Is the place of residence of the totality of this great world. Not the world that you could describe geographically or that is found in National Geographic magazines, but the vastness of this reality, this world far beyond the configuration of any particular planet, right there in the tip of a hair. What can that be that can be present fully and completely on the tip of a hair? Clearly it requires the dropping away of all concepts that would induce someone to say, what a bizarre thing to say. Impossible. Doesn't make any sense. Where do all such statements come from? Don't investigate too closely. Just allow them to drop away from your mind. He says, then your whole function is Buddha. And the whole Buddha is your functioning. That is to say, you are one with this one great reality. Therefore, you are manifesting Buddha. And all your functions are Buddha. But if you start stretching your mind and saying, well, that Buddha is, how can the... And you're caught. You've entered into the trap of thinking you have to think this through. By giving way to allowing to become real in your mind the idea, this doesn't make sense. Remember, all these words point somewhere. They're just pointing. They're pointing. So that if you can take the hint that there is nothing outside. There is no Buddha outside. There is only this functioning of this being. There is only the blowing of the wind through the trees. There is only this. And all is manifested there. Buddha, in its totality, is manifested there. This is not Shakyamuni Buddha, born a certain year and having died and having taught for 40 years and having eaten poison mushroom soup and whatever it is. This is not what we're talking about. That's a historic Shakyamuni. Grateful to him though we may be, when we say Buddha, this is another word for this fundamental reality that is manifested in everyone and can be realized, made real in the being of everyone, by learning this art and science of dropping away addiction to all these concepts and ideas, including any ones that you may have of enlightenment or Zen, or delusion, or gain or loss, anything. He says a blow, a shout, a statement, a device. There are no cliches here. In other words, you can't say Zen is about this or that. No, Zen is not a thing. Zen is just a temporary word for life. Everything, he says, is sealed with genuine realization. It is like the philosopher's stone turning iron into gold. Everything flows out from the true self. It's a wonderful image, this philosopher's stone. It's an alchemical image. The idea that there is this mysterious thing that can transform things that seem to have no value into that which is of greatest value. We say the lotus growing out of the mud and all of that. What this really means, in one of the alchemical texts from the Middle Ages in the Western Europe, it says, in every lead there is gold. So it is not so much transforming in some elemental way, but to treat it differently, so that you realize that every thought, which you previously might have thought was a delusional thought, every action that you might have thought was ungraceful or falls short of something, that too is a full manifestation of this one reality which we call Buddha. How can that be? Only by dropping away concepts that are the thing that keep us from realizing that. The ones that get us to say, well, that can't be so because, and so on. Such statements show that we are giving more reality to that which we have constructed with our minds, these stories, than we are giving to the actual sensory experience of this moment. So he says, after you have been studying for a long time and you have created a lot of subjective views and interpretations, this only makes you more learned. It is not the real thing. You must get so that when you stop one, you stop all. When you comprehend one, you comprehend all. You must see this original face and reach the scenery of this fundamental ground. So in other words, it is not that there are great thoughts and debased thoughts. But it is all thought. You stop one, you stop all. You stop all, you stop one. You just let them all be. No matter if they are about exalted things or base things, it doesn't matter. That's another world. That's a world that we have made up. A little baby coming into the world knows nothing of the exalted or the base. It knows nothing of gain or loss. It knows nothing of self-identification. It knows nothing of remorse that life didn't give to her or him a better deck of cards. Nothing. Just this, beyond all those ideas that we have accumulated over time. This is the path. So he says, after this, when you act, everything is ready-made. no longer depends on any mental effort. It is, as the proverb says, when the wind blows, the grasses bend down. Though the mountains and forests and cities and towns are still there, there is no duality. This is called being able to hold fast and act the master. The scale to weigh the lifeline of sentient beings is in your own hand, and you judge them according to what their minds do. Now again, he says, mountains and forests and cities and towns are still there, but there is no duality. In other words, one goes through every context of one's life equally, whether it is an empty zendo, or whether it is a crowded marketplace, whether it is a city, or whether it is the countryside, whether it is summer, whether it is winter, whether it is poverty or richness. What is true of them all is this moment. And this moment is not contaminated by poverty or richness, summer and winter, gain and loss, city or marketplace. There is none of that on there. There is just this, always just this. This is a place totally free of judgment, totally free of comparison, totally free of wanting anything outside of this moment. This is a place of the purity and expansiveness of mind. And finally, he says, this is called the uncontrived path. Isn't this the most essential, utterly peaceful and secure, great liberation? The uncontrived path. Not one that's made up, not one that's devised, not one that is based on concepts, not one that leads anywhere, starts anywhere, ends anywhere. This is the wonderful world of Zen. Like all these wonderful writings of Yuan Wu, they're all encouragements for each one of us, to find that way in every moment of our life. Then we inherit that which this wonderful life really makes possible for all of us. Let's end there tonight.